Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Brian Morris, filling in this week for News Director Steve Junker. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me this morning here in our Woods Hole studio is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Brian.
And joining us just a little bit later will be Tim Wood. Tim's editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll also be hearing from Teo Wolf of the Sandwich Enterprise, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner, Michael Bonner of the New Bedford Standard Times, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's start with a look at some of the stories making news around the region this week. And Gwen, of course, earlier this week, we had that horrific mass shooting at the Country Music Festival out in Las Vegas. And now comes word that emergency management officials, both statewide and here on the Cape and the islands, have been preparing for the possibility of a similar kind of event that could happen here.
I think this has probably been the story that's been most on everyone's mind wherever
Absolutely.
We go this week. And what they actually said when we talked to people, emergency officials on the Cape and at the state level, as you said, is that they were preparing before this happened for a mass casualty event. And, you know, this is sadly far from the first we've seen. There's San Bernardino and Florida. And
yep.
So they've been working on this for a while. A couple of things that are, I think, of interest to people here is that there is a there are not one but two emergency SWAT teams that would be assembled for this kind of an active shooter situation, and their position so that they could get anywhere on the Cape within an hour, which, you know, seems like a long time, but with the peninsula, we deal with, you know, the geography of the area.
Yeah, and it took them about an hour, am I right, to get up to the shooter's room in Las Vegas, even in that situation.
That's what the reports that we had were saying, the wire reports.
They did a terrific job, but it's, you know, nonetheless, it did take that long to kind of assess the situation and get there. We, of course, don't have any huge, you know, big hotels or anything like the Mandalay Bay or other places like they have in Las Vegas. But I guess these folks are looking at some of the venues we do have here on Cape Cod, the entertainment venues and public buildings and that sort of thing.
Well, preparations continue there. The other thing I found interesting when we talked to local officials was that one of the biggest problems after a mass casualty is figuring out who's been hurt, who's sadly been killed, you know, and dealing with the families. You know, we saw this a little bit at Newtown when we had this horrible situation at the school. And there's a lot of confusion, and they need someone who can coordinate that. That's one of the things that the county's also offering so that it doesn't all fall on the local town where an event happens. And, you know, it's also of note that the officials say that, sadly, it's not surprising that it took that long to get the situation under control in Las Vegas because, you know, you had all those buildings. You didn't know exactly where the gunfire was coming from, if there was one or more shooters. And I'm hearing both from our interview and also others around the state that the high-rise situation would be a difficult one, maybe the most difficult one to broach.
You just never know, you know, how those situations are going to play out. And the Times also spoke this week to a woman from Bourne who was at that concert when the shooting started.
She was just down the street having dinner in a hotel, and she and her party had gone into the hotel to have a drink while they waited for their table. And suddenly they were informed that the restaurant was closing and that everyone in the hotel was to shelter in place in the hotel. And she said, Kristen Joyce is her name, she said that it was the most terrifying thing that she had ever gone through. She considers herself a pretty calm person.
Right.
But after those initial responses, all she could hear was sirens. And then
they thought that maybe the shooter was coming their way.
Yes.
That's why there were all those people running sort of in the direction of the that where she was, right?
Well, I think some of those people were simply running from the first venue where it was actually happening.
But I mean,
wasn't
there confusion where she?
But there was confusion. That's why they were trying to secure the hotels and restaurants along that strip, because they thought the shooter was moving.
Yeah.
Even after they found that out, people who were running from the shooting at the Mandalay Bay came flooding in, and she described it as hundreds of people. So if you can imagine, that must have been fairly, terrifying. I can't imagine going through something like that.
Must have been traumatic, yeah. Gwen, also this week, the Coast Guard report came out. That was the report that examined the 2015 sinking of the cargo ship El Faro. And it places blame pretty squarely on the captain of that vessel for the incident in which all 33 aboard unfortunately lost their lives.
Yes, the report says that Captain Michael Davidson should have changed the El Faro's route as it was making its way between Jacksonville, Florida, and San Juan, Puerto Rico, to avoid Hurricane Joaquin's 150-mile-per-hour winds. And then it also says that when the 790-foot vessel got stuck, the captain should have taken more aggressive measures to save it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was also point-by-point recommendations that came out of that report, and those, I won't go into all of them, but they're interesting because they show the little steps that can lead to big tragedy, you know? There's an email system aboard, for example, that would have notified him of the worsening weather, and it hadn't been activated.
Yeah.
So they weren't getting those emails.
So it was like a domino effect of one thing leading a...
Four of the five Polish workers didn't speak English well. So even when he was giving orders, it was hard to get those implemented as quickly as they needed to.
There was also something about the oil level in the main engine. As they said, it was below the manufacturer's recommendation. And that also caused a kind of a domino effect, because that caused the engine to stall, and which mm-hmm. was crucial when they were really in the teeth of that gale.
And yeah, it's when you're taking a vessel or a plane, it sort of points to the need for checking every box on that checklist, because they add up.
Yeah, and of course we had, unfortunately, two of the people who died aboard that vessel were graduates of the Mass Maritime Academy, one from Winthrop and another, Jeffrey Mathias from Kingston, Keith Griffin of Winthrop and Jeffrey Mathias of Kingston. So just a tragic incident here, and we'll continue to follow that. Also, in other sort of maritime-related news, the Kennedy, T.S. Kennedy, pulled into the port of San Juan, Puerto Rico. And you spoke, they've been down there helping out with the hurricane relief efforts, and the Times spoke with Timothy de Moranville, who was on board that vessel, and he has some insights on what's happening down there in the aftermath of that.
He shared his observations with us. He's the relief chief engineer with the ship, and he said that the first thing that struck him was how dark it was, because, of course they don't have electricity, and he was just surrounded by darkness when they pulled into the port of San Juan. That was pretty overwhelming. And he talked a little bit about the physical landscape, about downed trees and downed power lines, long lines at gas stations. And those were things he saw from car rides around the island, that when he was out with the FEMA officials, Federal Emergency Management Agency officials.
Another function of the ship, this is a big, big vessel, too, and another function that it provides housing for, first responders, FEMA personnel. And I gather that it also provided housing for the folks that were the advanced people when the president was down there earlier in the week.
And also brought some supplies with it, 25 pallets of bottled water and 20 pallets of ready-to-eat meals to be distributed to the locals down there.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess Kennedy is scheduled to remain down in Puerto Rico for the rest of the month. And so we'll see how that goes.
I have to tell you, yeah. we walk along the canal each morning, and it feels like something's missing when it's not there.
Yeah. Okay, joining us on the phone right now is Tim Wood. Tim is editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Brian.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great. And Tim, an archaeological team doing some digging in Chatham recently made a pretty remarkable discovery down there.
Indeed. This group found what is pretty much agreed to be the actual home site of the first settler of Chatham, William and Ann Nickerson, who settled there on the banks of Ryder's Cove about 1664. Now, this was the fifth time that Craig Chartier and Plymouth Archaeological Rediscovery Project had conducted digs at the site of the Nickerson Family Association along Route 28, just across from Ryder's Cove. Now, in previous digs, they discovered evidence of occupancy at the site, which is sort of straddles land that's owned by the Nickerson Association and the Chatham Conservation Foundation. They found clay pipe stems, stoneware fragments, pottery shards, and other material like this. But last week, they struck pay dirt, literally, underneath some broken bricks and mortar. They found regularly sized stones that marked the Nickerson homestead's original hearth, which they said measured about 8 by 8 feet. And they also found post holes that were probably the corners of the house that William Nickerson built, which measured about 35 feet square, which they said was a pretty good sized house for the period. But William and Ann Nickerson had 10 kids, so it's understandable they would have a pretty big house.
Yeah.
What's interesting about this is that a decade ago, the Nickerson Association, which was founded by descendants of William and Ann Nickerson, about a decade ago, they placed a memorial marker on the site that they thought was the Nickerson homestead, and it turns out they were only about 50 feet off.
Wow.
Now, Chartier is going to continue to analyze the material he found during the dig and provide a more detailed report to the association, which will certainly be of interest to the thousands of descendants of William and Ann Nickerson, Chatham's original founders.
Yeah, so that's the next step. And Tim, I'm also wondering, are you aware if there are any plans in the works for any of these artifacts to be on display to the public? Will people be able to see either the site or any of the artifacts?
I think that's probably the next step for the Nickerson Association once they get this final report and can really demarcate exactly where the original house was and figure out it's sort of through a marsh area and into the pucker brush. I think they're going to, once they can figure out how to open that up, they'll do that, and I assume that they'll have the artifacts on display. They have a museum on the site in another historic home that they moved to the location that they've restored, and they use it for various historical displays. So I assume that'll be coming up probably over the next few months, and hopefully that'll be in place by next season.
Great. And Tim, also this week, just briefly, you reported on a new study that's looking at exactly where great white sharks go and kind of what they do once they leave our local waters for the winter. And the study yielded a few surprises compared to what had been known earlier.
Yeah, it turns out that they head out to sea, they head way out to sea. Data from 32 sharks that were tagged by Greg Skomel and his research team found that in the winter, most of the sharks head out beyond the continental shelf. Some go as far east as the Azores. And once they're in the deep water, the sharks are going even deeper, diving to depths 650 feet, even as far down as 3,000 feet. The question, Skomel says, is why they're doing this, what's there for them, and that's something they can't answer yet. They say scientists on the West Coast found similar behaviors in great white sharks, and they theorize that they're feeding on deep water prey, But exactly what that is, they just don't know. Another theory that they put forward is this may be some kind of mating behavior. Skomel said that no one's ever observed great white sharks mating, so they're curious about whether this is what's happening out there. One way they say they may try to find out is through autonomous underwater vehicles, which they've used off the Guadalupe Islands to track sharks as deep as 2,000 feet. So while Skomel's still engaged in his population study of the white sharks off the Cape here, it's yielding a lot of information about their nearshore behavior, but it's also helped filling in those gaps about what happens during the off-season when the sharks are not along the coast here.
All right. Tim Wood is editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Okay. Gwen Friss joins me in our Woods Hole studio this morning. And Gwen, a group of residents in Eastham wants to see a one-year moratorium on commercial development along a particularly dangerous stretch of Route 6. So what's the thinking behind this?
Well, let me start by telling you a little bit about that stretch, because the numbers really tell a story. We're talking about the area, 2.5 mile area between Old Orchard Road and the Wellfleet town line. And if you know that area, you know that taking a left is just taking your life in your hands. And the numbers show that in a two-year period, there were 100 curb cuts in that 2.5 mile
stretch. I used to work out that way, and I can attest it.
Take a right and turn around.
Oh, yeah, and so that's exactly what you have to do. Yeah.
And space in a two-year period from 2012 to 2014, there were 105 accidents. Now, what's planned for that area right now, what's on the books, is two affordable housing complexes and also a Dollar General store. And people are looking at how much more traffic that would generate, and it's raising concerns. So in order to buy a little time to look more closely at those issues, there's a proposal to have this designated as a DCPC, a District of Critical Planning Concern. Mm-hmm. And that would put a one-year moratorium on building and development in that one area. And so this is something that planners are looking at. And the next step is it goes beyond Eastham. It's not done just at the town level. The next step is that the Cape Cod Commission will vote on October 12th as to whether they'll recommend that moratorium.
And, of course, the other big factor in Eastham, the town's new municipal water system, is, I guess, part of what's driving the whole, at least one of the factors in the increased traffic and activity out there.
It makes it more attractive, to build and develop there.
Absolutely. Let's take a short break. We'll have more of the Friday News Roundup when we return. Sure. Welcome back. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup here on WCAI. I'm Brian Morris, filling in this week for News Director Steve Junker. And joining me from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. And Gwen, Entergy Corporation, we got word as this week they've reversed the decision on closing one of the other nuclear power plants that they own, and that raising some questions about the planned 2019 shutdown of the Pilgrim nuclear power plant here in Plymouth.
Yes, they've decided to prolong the operation at the Palisades nuclear power plant in Michigan, and that was supposed to close in October of 2018, but is instead going to continue operating, churning out power for another 4 years. So it's a significant extension. That's until 2022. But that's what's happening in Michigan, and a company spokesman for Entergy says that they have no intention of taking Pilgrim beyond the 2019 planned shutdown. So they say that it's a totally different situation. And
but a lot of the activists are saying, we'll breathe easier when the plant actually shuts down for good in 2019.
The doors are closed and safely closed so that nothing's leaking, nothing's wrong.
All right.
Yes, that is a concern. And especially when they look at this this owner and what's happening, around the country.
Sure. Well, turning from nuclear energy to renewable, cleaner energy at the moment, or clean energy, I should say, Marine Renewable Energy Collaborative received approval to test a tidal turbine in the Cape Cod Canal this week.
It did. It got a year-long renewable license to run the test site near the railroad bridge, and that permission comes from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. This is a fascinating story because it would supply quite a bit of energy, and people are saying that, proponents are saying that it would provide that energy without a lot of noise, without a lot of disruption to the environment. You know, bird strikes are a big concern for above ground turbines. So, so this is something I think that people on all sides of the question are taking a look at.
And these folks, I know, have been looking at doing this testing for quite a while, and they really like the canal because it's got this consistent current of about 3 to 4 knots in either direction. So I guess that's sort of ideal for what they're looking to do. So the conditions are that they don't want it to harm the railroad bridge or anything like that. They do
right.
have a few.
I think they're looking also to test and see what effect there might be on the biosystem, if you want to call it that, of the canal. A lot of people fish there, a lot of people, big recreation area. And it's interesting. This project was funded by a $300,000 state seaport economic council grant.
Okay. Also, the town of Truro looking to lift the town's ban on year-round condominium use.
Yes, this is something that people have talked about, you know, both in terms of it comes up in a lot of ways because there's the issue of people who say, I can only use my house half the time, so why should I have to pay all the taxes?
Right.
And that's just one of the issues that's come up in the past. But now that the town is looking at allowing those condos to be used year-round, it does, of course, come with conditions on how they have to be brought up to code. And there's some folks are saying that's there's about 500 condo owners involved here, especially those out on Beach Point, and they
it's
would have
be prohibitive
to,
for a lot of those.
Yeah, you know. They're just saying that you know, a lot of people are just not going to want to put in the year-round not equipment, but, you know, the systems, the heating
septic
and everything else that they would need. I think Selectman Jay Coburn said at the meeting that he'd be surprised if this resulted in even 10 to 20 new year-round places.
All right. We'll see how that develops over time. Let's go to Michael Bonner is a reporter with the New Bedford Standard Times, and he's going to join us on the phone right now. Good morning, Mike.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good.
Mike, you did some reporting this week on the how the New Bedford mayor's race is shaping up. It looks like it's down to Mayor Mitchell and a challenger.
Yeah, Charlie Perry is the challenger. He finished second among three candidates. Mitchell Garner was the other. But it really was a two-candidate race between Mayor John Mitchell, the incumbent, and Charlie Perry, a 30-year veteran on the police force here in New Bedford. So I think it's an interesting race because Perry, I think, tallied a lot more votes than anyone probably expected. I don't think anyone expected anything other than Mitchell Perry in the general election, but certainly Mitchell garnered the most votes with about 2,700, but Perry was only about 330 behind him. So it was a pretty close race, about 5 to 6 percentage points. So the final month, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out heading into the November 7th election.
Yeah. Now, Perry is a police veteran, correct? A 30-year police veteran, I think?
Yes, yes. Yeah. That's kind of his history in the city.
So it was a bit of a surprisingly closer, you know, race. But there was only, what, 10% of the city's registered voters that cast ballots?
Less than that, about 9.4, I believe it was, about 5,000 change voters. And the other aspect was, Perry won 16 precincts. Half of those precincts in the city were either in Ward 3 or Ward 6, and those two wards didn't have any city councilors running in preliminaries. Those city councilors running unopposed. So they had really low turnouts in Wards 3 and 6, those will probably be increased in terms of turnout in the general election. So it'll be interesting to see when more people come out in the general election how that'll affect the race.
All right. Now, Mayor Mitchell is seeking his fourth term in office. What's his confidence level going into this general election?
I think it was probably pretty confident heading into the preliminary, and I think with the close results or closer results, it may have been a small wake-up call, but then again, speaking with Mayor Mitchell, he hadn't really actively campaigned either. At this point, this is really where the campaigning starts, and I do think the incumbent has a little bit of a leg up just because, regardless of if the race was close or not, because he's doing events, he's out there. He said by his nature of the job, he's out there campaigning. There's a lot of events going on. So while it's kind of a double-edged sword where the mayor's job doesn't give you a lot of time to campaign because you're busy, it also gives you some opportunities to campaign in press conferences and such.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it all plays out. Michael Bonner is a reporter with the New Bedford Standard Times. Appreciate you coming on, Mike. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing. Anytime.
Okay, great. Gwen Friss is with me in our Woods Hole studio on this edition of the Friday News Roundup. And Gwen, the Steamship Authority is looking to address early morning noise complaints along the road that leads to the Woods Hole Ferry Terminal. This is not the first time this subject has come up. What are they proposing here?
Well, we're talking about the road that goes right outside your studio.
That's right. I drive it every day.
and
at that time.
What they're proposing is there's a meeting Monday, and the general manager of the authority, Robert Davis, said that I might be wrong about that. The meeting might have been Wednesday, but this week.
Yep. That's okay.
The people are concerned about the noise, especially from the big trucks. So what they're proposing is that they'll still have that that run, that first early morning 5:30 a.m. trip leaving the Woods Hole Terminal. But what they're trying to do is to have the bigger trip, the bigger trucks, and by that I mean things that are bigger than 40 feet, schedule later passage. And they're going to offer financial incentives to those truck owners to try and make that worth their while. So that means that normally it cost, in 2017, it cost $154.50 to book your truck over to the island. And this incentive would vary from $19.50 for a 40-foot truck to $105 discount for a 60-foot truck. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are the more noisy vehicles coming onto the ferry.
Right.
They have some other options, not options, but plans that they had proposed at this meeting. And one of them is to use the Sankaty. Am I saying that right?
Sankaty, I think it
Sankaty.
Is.
Sankaty, okay. You live
right
here.
That,
this,
yes.
Yeah,
Sankaty.
No. Yeah. But to use that as a dedicated freight vessel, which would take any trucks with hazardous waste, hazardous materials,
yep,
that were going to the island, that would take them on just that ferry. And they think that would help a little bit with the noise problem. But more importantly, even though it would cost the Steamship Authority a little, it would add about $250,000 to their $98 million budget. They say that they feel like they would have a better handle on making sure that those materials are tracked, and mm-hmm, and that if there were any kind of an issue with, you know, spillage or anything, that they'd have everything in one place.
And as they've been doing for quite a while, they're also examining that slight possibility that maybe they could get a freight carrier to start service from New Bedford to Martha's Vineyard. I guess that depends on finding, you know, the right carrier. And that would also involve a lot of upgrades to the New Bedford State Pier to do that. So that's very much up in the air as well. But that
it's a big package, too.
It is.
To do that.
All right. Let's go to Ed Miller, Associate Editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Hi, Brian. Good to be with you.
You too. Thanks for coming on. Ed, looks like it turned out to be a pretty good tourist season out there at the end of the Cape, but there was a lot of last-minute scrambling because of the J-1 visa situation.
Well, yes. As the season winds down and we've been talking to business people around town, it's clear that it was a good season for almost everyone, but it was full of issues. Right. And the worker staffing problem was really the biggest one. There was so much uncertainty in the early part of the season with the delays in getting the both the J-1 and H-2B visa people approved. And so many businesses really depend on these foreign workers that people were really scrambling. And some of the student workers, especially who come on J-1 visas basically for the summer, they were working 2, 3, and even 4 jobs.
Wow.
Because of the shortage. And some people who had night shifts were pretty much falling asleep on the job. It was kind of a tough year in that way.
Now, some of these folks didn't arrive until much later in the summer. Am I right about that? Or?
Yes, that's right. It depended really on when the business people got in their applications, especially for the H-2B workers, because what happened was, in past years, there was an exemption for returning workers, and so they didn't count towards the cap, that is the limit on the number. And so a lot of business people who were expecting their returning workers to just be able to come had to wait, and many didn't arrive until midsummer.
So it was a real scramble.
That was terrible.
And I understand that the restrictions could be even harsher next summer, so I guess we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah, a lot of people are nervous about it because there's talk of further restricting the number of visas for next year.
Yeah. Another story in the news, the big Herring River Restoration Project is set to go before the Cape Cod Commission.
That's right. Now, this, of course, is a project that's been in the works for many years. Just to give a little background, this is one of the largest tidal wetland restoration projects ever planned on the East Coast, total of 890 acres of the Herring River estuary in Wellfleet and Truro is planned to be restored largely by the replacement of the dike that was built in 1909 on the Herring River at Chequesset Neck in Wellfleet. The Herring River Restoration Committee, which is in charge of the science and technical operations part of the project, reported on September 25th to the Executive Council that they are ready to go before the Cape Cod Commission to seek the first regulatory approvals, permits to rebuild that dike and 2 other smaller dikes in Wellfleet. It's going to be a fairly long process to get all the necessary approvals, and they're hoping to actually begin construction in the year 2021.
All right. Ed Miller is associate editor at the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for being on the roundup this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you, Brian.
Great. Gwen Friss is with me in our Woods Hole studio. And Gwen, just want to talk briefly before we go to a break here. Major harbor reconstruction project at Sacotucket Harbor in Harwichport set to get underway shortly.
Well, something's getting underway
We're not sure what.
And this is the concern of some of the selectmen is that this has been, if you go back to our earlier stories, this has been a winnowing of the project. And, of course, it all comes down to money. Mm. Originally, they were looking at town officials were hoping to have a $3 million rehab of the town's land-based buildings, parking lots, and other assets completed at the same time that the $7 million reconstruction and dredging of the harbor began. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like that's happening because when the bids were opened this August, they were too high to complete all the work under the $3 million budget that voters approved at the May town meeting. So they started to look at the project to see how they could save money, essentially. And we had already reported that they had scaled back from a 60-seat waterfront restaurant to a snack shack serving only takeout and shrinking a ticket office to a small shed. There were additional cost cutting that they're looking at now are things like substituting some of the exterior touches and the fencing in order to make it cheaper to complete.
Right.
One of the biggest changes is placing a new maintenance building on hold and relegating the Snack Shack to an add-on that may or may not get done depending on when the money runs out. And the selectmen, some of the selectmen are saying, is this even the project that the voters approved last May? You know, if you change it this much.
Doesn't resemble what was
originally.
Does it?
Yeah, no. You know, so that's a little bit of concern. And then one other big part of it is that they wanted to redo, for functional reasons, they wanted to redo the Harbor Masters building, and that's now been moved to phase two of the project, and that was kind of the impetus for the whole thing in the first place. So there is in the next step for this story, there are new beds scheduled to be opened on October 26th with a decision reached by November 6th. And the town also has at least three grant applications pending, including one for $1 million from the Seaport Economic Council. We had just talked about them giving tax money for another project here on the Cape. So that'll be a developing. That would allow them to do more.
Okay, we'll see how that plays out. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup on WCAI. Let's take a short break. We have more of the News Roundup when we return. Welcome back. This is the Friday News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Brian Morris, filling in this week for News Director Steve Junker. And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. And Gwen, another story making news this week. Animal conservation groups say they're going to sue the government unless, in the wake of the deaths of 15 North Atlantic right whales, they want those whales to be better protected.
I'm going to ask you if we can go back for a moment before we go on to that story, Brian, because I did want to mention the story we just talked about with the harbor reconstruction. In Tuesday's paper and also on our website at CapeCodTimes.com is a graphic that shows a map of all the proposed changes and also the harbor, and that can be very helpful for people as well.
Okay,
I meant
great.
To mention that.
Great.
Now,
on to the
sorry about that.
No problem. No problem. It's a good resource to have.
On to the conservationist threats to sue, they actually filed a 6-month intent. If nothing is done in the next 6 months, they would sue. This has been filed to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Whew. Get extra pay for that one.
Exactly.
As well as the Fisheries and Oceans Canada, because, you know, this is not just our country. It spans both. It's sort of interesting that this threat to sue is part of this story, but it's came out partly, too, because the Canadian government has been completing necropsies on the whales that have been found there on the whale carcasses. And they found that four died due to blunt trauma with internal bleeding, and one had a fishing gear entanglement, and another one they haven't finished the autopsy and necropsy yet, but the carcass was entangled in gear. So certainly the overwhelming amount of this evidence points to fishing, you know, to whales getting involved with fishing boats,
and
I think that's what's pushing the threat to sue.
And, you know, 15 deaths in one summer period when there are only 500 odd or so of these animals left in the world, that's a big deal. That's
actually only 458 left, so, you know, you're right, close to 500, but the numbers are going in the wrong direction. Those 12 deaths in Canada and the total of 15 represents about a 3% decrease because the population is so small.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll see. We'll keep an eye on that one and see what happens. Let's go down to Tao Wolf, a reporter with the Sandwich Enterprise. Good morning, Tao.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. You have a story in this week's paper about a tentative plan to move some pickleball courts in Sandwich. Tell us about that.
Well, as you probably know, pickleball is a wildly popular sport on Cape Cod and throughout the country. The pickleballers in Sandwich say that it's the most popular game in America. I'm not sure how you measure that, but
right.
in any event, they in Sandwich, they are sharing courts right now with basketball players and tennis players, and they would very much like to have more courts in that area, but the recreation director, Guy Boucher, has told them the lines, there's too many lines there as it is. It's very confusing, and he didn't want to add any more courts there. He was investigating some overgrown tennis courts at the Sandwich Hollows Golf Club, which are haven't been used in years, and they are very much overgrown, and there's weeds and trees poking through them. And he had gotten an estimate from a Vermont company to resurface them, but it would cost about $120,000. And that is a little bit more than he had anticipated. So the short story is that it's going to be a while before they get courts that are dedicated strictly to pickleball. But they will keep playing. I know they're very, very dedicated.
Yeah, and this is, I guess it is, you mentioned it was, you know, wildly popular. Am I right that pickleball is sort of a hybrid of racquetball and tennis? And, you know, can you just describe a little bit about why people love it so much?
Yes, it's kind of a combination of various table paddle sports and badminton and tennis. And it's played with rackets, obviously, and a wiffle ball. And you switch partners. You play a number of games and you switch partners, and it's a very good way to meet people and become social with people. And it's extremely popular among the active adult set, but apparently, according to the pickleballers in Sandwich anyway, it's also becoming popular among younger generations. They describe it as a multi-generational sport.
All right. Tao Wolf is a reporter with the Sandwich Enterprise, and there's more information about this story that you can find at capenews.net. Thanks, Tao.
Thank you.
Okay. And Gwen, just briefly, neighbors of a Wellfleet shellfish farmer are concerned about a new shellfish cooler that she has in her yard. What's this about?
This has been going on for a while because originally the cooler was approved by the building inspector, Justin Post, in that town. But the neighbors, led by Deborah Dickinson, have complained. It's a good size. It's 160 square feet and 10 feet tall. So they're saying that's a commercial building on a residential lot, and it's owned by former selectman and shellfish farmer Berta Brunisch, and she has of course appealed to the Zoning Board of Appeals, and right now they're in a 20-day, I think it's 20 days appeal period before a decision comes down, but the Zoning Board of Appeals had originally upheld Post's decision.
That it was a piece of shellfish equipment as opposed
that it was okay. That it was okay to have it there. That it was
official. Okay, yeah,
it was initially that this, like as I said, this has been going on for a while.
Okay, yep. Gotcha.
But then Post actually changed his mind, his outlook, and determined that the cooler was indeed a piece of shellfish equipment in an existing home occupation. And once that happened, it became a problem. So now we're at the point where the Zoning Board of Appeals will decide whether they're going to reverse themselves or whether they're going to allow her to keep that in her yard. It's her side yard. Right. But Deborah, the neighbor leading this, her house overlooks it, so you can see in pictures that we have on the website that that it's like a big flat metal roof.
Well, Wellfleet, of course, being one of the top shellfish producers in the state, and I understand there are 10 or 12 other similar types of coolers in the town of Wellfleet, too, so I guess.
There are, I guess the difference there is that they're saying that they're using as an alternative to winter storage, and such as pits and cellars, as opposed to the contention that this is a commercial operation.
Great. All right. Let's go now to George Brennan, news editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
George, I'm really trying to resist the urge to call this first story a sting operation, but it kind of was. This is about a beekeeper who was called on to really remove quite a sizable hive from a house on the island this week. Tell us about it.
You know, in a week of really big stories on Martha's Vineyard, there was none bigger than this one. James Kozak is a beekeeper, and on social media, people were following this this idea that he was going to pull this massive beehive out of a house that was about to be demolished. He estimated it was about 6 feet tall,
gosh,
6 inches thick, and 300 pounds.
That's amazing.
So we caught wind of this, and we were actually there as he was pulling the this massive beehive out of the wall, making the final cuts and lowering it to the ground. I should say, this was on the second floor of this house, this vacant house. He was up on scaffolding. If you can imagine this, up on scaffolding with bees buzzing around him. He had a suit on,
mm-hmm.
but still, I wouldn't want to be on the scaffolding in the first place, and I wouldn't want to have bees buzzing around me.
Yeah, that I think I'd pass on that one, too.
If you could just imagine that combination. But all the while, he was very steady and, you know, just doing what he had to do to remove this. He said this was a rare opportunity to be able to pull out the whole hive from a house because they were going to demolish this afterwards.
Wow.
He sells honey here on the island, and he's going to relocate the hive and, you know, harvest the honey from it, and he'll be selling it at various farm stands across the island and shops like Kronig's here. I really encourage people to go to the website, click on the story, look at the video. I mean, it's very short video, but it's fun to watch because you really get a sense of the operation that he went through to do this, sort of an engineering marvel, and at the same time, very scary. You'll even see him pointing out that we keep moving further and further back as we're taking this video, both myself and the photographer, in bringing you this story, got stung.
Wow, yeah. Boy, it sounds like it's one for the books, George.
Buzzworthy.
Yeah, oh boy. But I'm bummed. Also, another story, a much more serious note. There's a proposal to open a gun shop on the vineyard in Vineyard Haven, and I would imagine this debate has probably been intensified at least somewhat in light of last week's events in Las Vegas. What's happening with that?
Yeah, you couldn't ask for the timing to be any worse for this individual who wants to add some guns to a store he operates on Main Street in Vineyard Haven. His name is Ruben Kronig, and he's not looking to sell pistols, any kind of automatic weapons. These are collector's items. They start at like $20,000 for these shotguns that can be used for skeet shooting, and many of them are closer to $100,000. But understandably, there are people who are concerned that he's going for this firearms license.
Right.
He does not have it yet. The police chief is vetting it at the moment. That includes a criminal background check, mental health checks. There's also a federal license that he has to obtain before he'll be allowed to sell. But I think in the weeks and probably months to come, there'll be a lot more discussion about this.
All right, George, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, George Brennan is news editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks for joining us, George.
Thanks, Brian. Enjoy the weekend.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Gwen, just very briefly, Anthony's Cumaquid Inn in Yarmouth Port won't be able to secure the liquor license so it can reopen.
That's right. It's a 42-year-old Yarmouth Port restaurant that a lot of people know, but it's been closed for nearly 2 years, and that license will remain suspended despite the restaurant's efforts. I don't think we have time to go into too much, but
they were just basically unable to get the renovations done in time, right?
That's it. And the story that we have here does go into a bit of the history. So
okay, we'll point folks toward that. That's in the paper. I want to thank Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, who joined me in the studio. And thanks to our other contributors today, Teo Wolf of the Sandwich Enterprise, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Banner, Michael Bonner of the New Bedford Standard Times, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Brian Morris.